From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Winners are celebrating their Peabody Awards, sometimes called the Pulitzer of Broadcasting. It's given out by the University of Georgia. We're going to talk to the director about whom he and his colleagues chose to honor this year and why. Also in the program, a new study shows African-American women face higher breast cancer mortality rates than non-Hispanic white women. Are racial disparities in treating breast cancer to blame? That's just ahead this hour, but we'd like to hear from you. Are you a breast cancer survivor? Tell us your story. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk, or you can post to Facebook. We might feature your comments on the show. Well, Georgia is feeling some unusual seasonal lows. Just ahead, we talk about why springtime has taken its time getting here and what that means for you. But first, let's go where some people and fruits do not mind the cold. In fact, Georgia's trademark peaches embrace it, or at least if it comes at precisely the right time. Peach season starts in a couple of weeks. Here to talk about this season's crop is Mark Sanchez, CEO of Lane Southern Orchards in Fort Valley, Georgia. He joins us on the line this morning from the orchard. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Generally speaking, what kind of weather do peaches like?
Well, generally speaking, peaches like a cold winter. You know, peaches need a certain amount of cold temperatures throughout the winter. We call them cold hours. That's defined as temperatures below 45 degrees during the months between the middle of October to the middle of February. Most of our peaches need 650 to 850 cold hours during that time.
Right. And did they get them this year?
We did. We did. We actually got our cold hours earlier this year, as opposed to last year, which was a very, very warm winter, if you recall.
Sure.
So we got enough hours this year.
And but then once you've had your cold hours and then the trees start to bloom, then cold can be a real problem, right?
That's true. That's true. If you recall, we had a lot of cold earlier in the winter. By February, we had enough cold hours, and then February was a very warm month for us. So the trees bloomed a few weeks early, and then we had a cooler period in March, which caused us some stress.
Yeah, because if they freeze, no peaches. So, big question, how are this year's peaches looking?
We're in pretty good shape, Adam. We had a good early bloom. We did have some cold in March. We did see a little bit of damage to the peaches that were developing. But that's not unusual in the peach business. Something like that happens just about every year. So we're optimistic. We'll start in the middle of May, ramp up to pretty good volume by middle of June.
Again, compare it to last year. Last year was a terrible year for peach growers in Georgia, right?
Last year was awful. We did not have enough cold, and so the trees didn't bloom properly. When they did bloom, then we had a freeze event in March, and that hurt us as well. So last year was a year we really would like to forget. This year is going to be much better.
What happens? I always wonder we hear about bad times for farmers with regard to one crop or another. How does it really affect you when you have a crop fail in a bad weather year? I mean, y'all have crop insurance, right?
We have crop insurance, and that helps quite a bit. It helps you get a lot of your production costs back. We also diversify. We have, in our company, we also grow pecans, and we also have a pretty substantial retail business. So we try to have enough alternatives that if we have an issue with one crop, then the other sides of the business help out.
With the climate in general warming, is it getting harder to grow peaches in Georgia? I mean, other states like California produce more peaches a year than Georgia, yet Georgia retains its mantle of the peach state. Is that mantle purely ceremonial at this point?
No, I don't think so. Georgia's the peach state. Maybe we don't grow the same volume of peaches that California does, but we feel like the peaches grown in Georgia are the best you'll find in the world. So, the quality is superior to any other product out there.
All right. Well, last question. Down there at Lane Southern Orchards in Fort Valley, what do you do with your peaches? Eat them out of hand?
We do. Yeah, all our peaches are grown for the fresh market. We don't process any peaches. So everything that we grow is picked today, packed tomorrow, and is in the grocery store within 48 hours of the time it leaves the tree.
If you were to cook them, or at least cut them and present them alongside some other food product, what would you do?
Best way to cook peaches is to put them in an old-fashioned southern peach cobbler. That's right. You can't beat that. Put a little vanilla ice cream on top of it. That's the best thing you can eat.
Nice, nice, nice. That's Mark Sanchez, CEO of Lane Southern Orchards in Fort Valley, Georgia, letting us know that this year's peach crop is looking a whole lot better than last year's, which was really, really wrecked by that warm winter that we had. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Adam.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. This weekend, if you're like me and you live in the South because you like the hot weather, you can expect some much-needed relief. Temperatures across the state should reach up into the 70s at least. For the past few weeks, though, spring has scarcely sprung. In Atlanta, lows approached century-old records from this time last from this time of year. And in Middle and South Georgia, the National Weather Service projects a 40% chance of below-normal temperatures. So you may not want to put away your winter clothes just yet. Greg Postel joins me. He's a meteorologist with the Weather Channel. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing all right. Spring officially began March 20, but people have been holding out their coats and their turtlenecks throughout April. What explains the unseasonably cold and sometimes just straight up cold weather that we have been experiencing in Georgia and then across the Southeast?
A weird looking jet stream, basically, is the way to put it. And I think we're actually kind of fortunate here in Georgia to have been spared some of the worst, because if you think about it nationally, much of the country has been seeing record cold for weeks on end, beginning really back in March and even late February. But here in the Southeast, you're right, in Georgia in particular, it has been colder than average and gloomier than average, frankly. I mean, a lot of us are dying to see the sun, but really haven't seen much of it. And we can thank, going back to your question, a jet stream that has been in awkward positions, unlike it has been in recent years.
Okay, so yeah, that big jet of wind that goes across all of North America is bringing cold air from the north down lower than it normally does down to us. We've seen estimates that things could stay cool until almost mid-May. What kind of weather would we normally be having at this time? I mean, Facebook threw up a memory on me today from last year where my lawn was just like green and lush. And it's still got like brown spots from the winter left on it.
That's exactly right. I mean, what's happened is that the foliage has taken a little bit of a beating, taking a break, right? But there's good news on the way. I'm going to go back to your original point there. I really believe, I'm going to take a counter argument here. I think as we head into even the first couple of days in May, most of Georgia will get back to average or maybe even above average temperatures. So I'm going to disagree a little bit with some of those projections that it is going to remain cool through mid-May. I think we're turning the corner actually pretty abruptly, and I think that's really good news. But what we can expect on average across Georgia, you know, in South Georgia, normally this time of year, we're in the upper 70s. In North Georgia, low to mid-70s with generally overnight lows in the 50s. And we haven't seen those kind of numbers sustained. Occasionally, we've been into the 70s and low 80s across Georgia, but really the sustained sort of average April and May temperatures, we haven't seen, but I think they're coming, and I think they're coming soon. So just hold on a little bit.
I am holding.
right.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, where I will never live again if I can avoid it. My friend, not because Pennsylvania is not a lovely state. It is. I just hate the cold. My friends up there are like they are despondently depressed because they have just been getting so many winter storms deep into spring. What's going on up there?
Okay, this is a very good question. The jet stream, which we talked about, which is sort of responsible for delivering cold air and warm air in different parts of the globe, has been in this weird-looking position and shape really since February. And, you know, there's some thinking that there are some very, very peculiar dynamics going on at the very high altitudes in the stratosphere, in the high stratosphere, that have kind of worked their way down into the part of the atmosphere where we live. And over the sustained period of about the last 6 to 8 weeks, we've been suffering the consequences of a jet stream that has been shaken up, sort of normally it flowing around the globe from west to east, keeping the cold air at bay over the higher latitudes of, you know, Canada and the North Pole. It's been beaten up and it's taken on these weird positions, and it's really unfortunately had that pattern where the coldest of air has been delivered right over North America. Other parts of the world have been just fine. They've gotten out scot-free from the what's happened to the jet stream, but we haven't here in the lower 48. And to sort of take a bigger view, I mean, the United States has been suffering the consequences of this, but the rest of the world in many senses has been actually been spared quite a bit and been enjoying some milder than average temperatures.
There's some research now to show that weather has begun to just stay the same for longer periods of time than it used to. This is a phenomenon known as persistence. What does that mean?
Well, persistence refers to the fact that the weather that you got now is going to be the weather that you're going to keep getting likely for 1, 2, 3 weeks out. And there is some thinking in the science that the patterns are kind of slowing down a little bit. In other words, that fast river of air, I keep talking about the jet stream, but that's really where it boils down to. The thing that carries weather systems through and doing so on a regular basis, oftentimes where you get sunny days for 3 in a row and then you get rain once and then sunny days. That has kind of been thrown out the window now. We're getting these large circulations that don't want to move. So if you're stuck underneath bad weather, oftentimes it's going to stick with you for a couple of weeks. And if you're under the good weather side of it, you're lucky because it's going to be with you for a couple of weeks. But this is something that the sort of overall circulation globally is starting to see more and more of in recent decades.
The perennial question for folks like you, Greg, is this all part of the broader trend of global warming?
It is consistent with global warming. That is for a fact, because some of my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin in Madison have recently shown that the size of the cold pocket that typically sits over the North Pole, for example, in the Northern Hemisphere, has been systematically shrinking over time, over years and decades. And so what we're seeing is a sort of a response to that, where it's just blowing away. It's no longer able, the jet stream is no longer able to contain that cold air at the poles as effectively as it used to. And instead, it is delivering it southward into places like, well, where we live. So the fact that it's getting colder may be kind of ironic. You might think, how is that possible or counterintuitive to a global warming? But it is all part of the puzzle, and it's certainly what we've been seeing consistent with climate change.
That's meteorologist Greg Postel of the Weather Channel talking about this unseasonably cool spring we've been having in Georgia. He predicts things are going to warm up soon. Yay if you like that. Boo if you don't.
Just a few
Greg,
days.
Thank you
just
so
a
much.
Few days. Okay.
You're all right.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Every year, the George Foster Peabody Awards honor stories that matter. Founded and archived at the University of Georgia, the awards are often called the Pulitzer Prize for broadcast. This year's Peabody winners were announced this week. Jeffrey Jones is the director of the awards, and he joins me now from GPB's studio at WUGA in Athens. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
Hey, real quick, how did the University of Georgia, of all places, come to be the arbiter of excellence in broadcasting?
Well, there was a committee at the National Association of Broadcasters in the late 1930s that was looking to award excellence in radio. You have to remember early on, those radio shows were Amos and Andy and the Green Hornet, and a lot of people didn't feel as if radio was as important as the printed word. Anyway, the Lambden K at WSB in Atlanta was on that committee, and a woman named Leslie Smithgall, who's still alive at 106 years old, reached out and connected the Dean of Grady College of Communication here at the University of Georgia with Lambden K. And the next thing you know, they had created this first award for broadcasting in the United States.
Just a matter of getting there first. Okay. And we should emphasize that the Peabody Awards not just excellence in journalism programming on radio and television, but also fiction work as well. Let's start with the entertainment category. Among the winners this year is HBO's Insecure. Here's a clip of the main character, Issa, rapping in front of her mirror.
Do you want your man or not? Do you know your plans or not? You gonna go back home or not? You gonna claim your throne or not? Is you Khaleesi or that other name I don't remember?
So, Jeffrey, tell us about Insecure and what you like about it.
Yeah, well, I think the board was really interested in finally seeing a narrative about young African-Americans in an urban setting that really moves away from a lot of the stereotypical representations we've seen in the past. These are two young people making their way through relationships and strange work situations. And it was somewhat of its authenticity or maybe its everydayness that was very appealing. Issa Rae is clearly a very talented performer. That show, of course, if audiences aren't aware Claire arose from a webisode that she had created, Awkward Black Girl, on YouTube, and she's become one of the big breakout stars of that kind of organic creation in the digital space onto a network like HBO.
Netflix's Hasan Minhaj, Homecoming King, also won in the entertainment category. That was fortuitous, given that I think Hasan Minhaj is the host of your awards gala this year, so that must have been nice for him. Let's listen to a clip of that special on Netflix.
My dad's from that generation, like a lot of immigrants, where he feels like if you come to this country, you're going to endure some racism. But for me, like a lot of us, I was born here. So I actually have the audacity of equality.
That's a nice clip.
Yeah, it's this great one-man show that Hasan Minhaj did for Netflix. What did you and the board like about this one?
You know, stand-up comedy doesn't always win Peabody Awards, but we felt that this was much more of a memoir than it was just a stand-up act. The clip you played really shows Hasan wrestling with the immigrant experience and what it's like to grow up as a first-generation American and a Muslim. We just found it very poignant and moving, him showing a lot of vulnerability, but also a lot of humor as he, you know, wrestles with these situations, but also self-critical of himself and his own biases.
A lot of exciting work happening on internet audio, on podcasts. One of the winners in the radio and podcast category as it exists now is S-Town, a podcast from the creators of Serial and This American Life. It's about a man named John B. McLemore who wants to solve a murder mystery in his Alabama town. Let's listen to a clip of John B. from S-Town.
Something's happened. Something has absolutely happened in this town. There's just too much little crap for something not to have happened. And I'm about had enough town and things that goes on.
And now you know, if you can hear past the beep, what the S in S-Town stands for. Jeffrey, why did S-Town get a Peabody?
I can't say too much about it because it would spoil it for all the listeners other than everybody who has listened to this is truly amazed that you have a nonfiction story that seems so completely fictional in its appeal to the listener's appetite for good storytelling.
On the subject of content creating organizations that are really stretching the definition of broadcast and opening up all kinds of new creative possibilities to themselves on internet-only platforms, we have Vice. Vice won the Peabody in the news category for its coverage of last year's violent neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Let's listen to a clip of that. So, Jeffrey, every news organization covered what happened in Charlottesville. What made Vice's approach different such that you and the board wanted to award it the Peabody?
They were the only one that we would call being embedded. There were plenty of reports that stand outside, but the reporter in this situation got squarely in with this group that we follow around, including cameras capturing the eventual tragedy of the person being run over by a car. So it was truly her access, and there was lots and lots of reporting going on, but it was the firsthand cinema verite, fly on the wall access that the viewer gets. And remember that this came out a few days before Donald Trump then goes on and says, there's good people on both sides. Well, yeah. It's really hard to see the good people on that racist side when you've seen a piece like this.
The Peabody's give the Peabody Career Achievement Award, and this year's award goes to none other than the comedian Carol Burnett. Here is a clip from one of Carol's favorite sketches where she's teaching her mother how to play the board game Sorry.
And when you land on that opponent, you pick up this little bell and you ring it and you say, sorry! And then that opponent has to go right back to where he started, see? You pick up the bell and you go, sorry!
Jeffrey, it's one thing to look at all of the moving pictures and audio media that has been created in a given year and try to decide what's the best stuff to honor. That's one thing. It's a whole other thing to give out something like a Lifetime Achievement Award. There's just literally a whole world of people to whom you could give it. How did you settle on Carol Burnett?
Well, this is the year of women, and who better of a trailblazer than Carol Burnett? I mean, she was such the comedic icon for people of a certain generation. She had only received a Peabody for her comedy in 1962 when she was on the Gary Moore Show. So for whatever reason, the Peabody Board never awarded the landmark CBS telecast that so many of us watched. So there was somewhat of an oversight in recognizing her. But also, she's coming out with new material this year. In fact, on May the 4th, she has a new show launching. So it just seemed really time to tip our hat, to make sure that she's in that pantheon with the Norman Lears and the Sir David Attenboroughs and others, for people who really radically altered the landscape of American television broadcasting and comedy.
That's Jeffrey Jones. He's director of the Peabody Awards, which were announced this week. Folks call them the Pulitzers for broadcast, and they are given out every year by the University of Georgia. You can find a list of all of the winners at gpbnews.org. Jeffrey, thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam. It's nice to be here.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. New guidelines released this month say African-American women face greater risks associated with breast cancer and should be screened earlier. The recommendations come from the American College of Radiology and the Society of Breast Imaging. Both groups show that African-American women are 42% more likely to die from breast cancer than non-Hispanic white women. Here to discuss this is Dr. Otis Brawley of the American Cancer Society. Good morning, Doc.
Oh, good morning.
So forgive me for being cynical, but here we have two professional organizations of people who do medical scans saying that a certain class of women should get more and earlier medical scans. In your opinion, is this an example of those groups trying to drum up more business for themselves, or is there really a medical need here?
I would not criticize them and say that they're trying to drum up more business. I would say that a little bit of their emphasis is a little off. We've got good studies to show, you know, in many areas of the country, black women are more likely to get mammography than white women, yet they still have higher death rates. The real reason for the disparity between black and white women from breast cancer is a lack of access to care, number one. Then some differences in biology, which actually can be taken care of through more preventative health, starting with how children eat, gain weight, and exercise. So I would like to address the disparity looking broadly, not just at mammography. By the way, the American Cancer Society does believe that women age 40 to 44 need to have a discussion with their doctor about mammography, and many of them should get mammography starting at age 40. Women age 45 to 55 should be getting it every year, and women age 55 and above need to have a discussion with their doctor and decide if they should get it every year or every 2 years. But mammography is not the reason for the disparity. The disparity is because a lot of women who are actually diagnosed with breast cancer do not have access to care and do not have access to good care.
Right. And the reasons for that are obvious, having to do with poverty, among other things. But in a recent piece that you wrote for NPR, you said that many African Americans lack trust in the healthcare system.
Absolutely.
Why'd you say that?
It is a fact, being black myself and having grown up in the inner city, it is a fact that a large number of blacks have been exploited by a number of things, including in medicine. And sometimes when doctors tell people to do something and you're a minority, you're suspicious, sometimes rightfully so. We have been taken advantage of in the past.
What's the solution there?
Well, the solution is that doctors need to be more personable and more reasonable, and patients need to be interested in their health, and there needs to be a good dialogue. And when there is a good dialogue, good things can happen. By the way, when we talk about black-white disparities in breast cancer, I would point out there's 7 states in the United States where there is no black-white disparity in breast cancer mortality anymore. We have overcome the disparity in 7 states. So there is a reason for hope, and there is a reason why we need to stress getting people adequate care, adequate preventative care, as well as adequate treatment. When I talk about prevention, I'm talking about coaching people on what they should be eating from birth onward, coaching people on exercise, coaching people on maintaining a normal body weight, and then, of course, not smoking. And then when we're talking about breast cancer, figuring out when you should get mammography, getting good high-quality mammography. And there is a quality difference by race in many areas of the United States, and then getting good treatment.
Where are those states where there is no longer any racial disparity in breast cancer mortality, and what are they doing?
Well, the first state to have a disparity go away was Massachusetts, and we can blame that on Mitt Romney and Romney Care, as well as the fact that they have good medical care in Massachusetts, and all of a sudden it became available to everybody. A number of the other states are in the Northeast, Delaware, Connecticut, Minnesota. I would note that the state that has the worst black-white disparity in the United States is Mississippi, followed closely by Georgia.
And what are we doing wrong?
We have a large number of people who do not have access to good care. You know, I practice in Atlanta, and I literally have had people who knew that they had a breast cancer, watched it grow for several years because they did not have good access to care, and then finally went very sick, end up in an emergency room.
That's Dr. Otis Brawley, Chief Medical and Scientific Officer of the American Cancer Society, talking about racial disparities in healthcare, particularly for breast cancer patients of color. Dr. Brawley, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.